Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, September 12th, 2024, we're delighted to host a discussion on judicial elections and free speech, varying approaches to handling the intersection of judicial elections and the constitutional guarantee of a right to free speech, all featuring an all-star panel. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we'll keep our introductions of our guests today brief, certainly more brief than their distinguished careers deserve. So I will highly recommend, if you're interested in learning more, that you check out their full bios at fedsoc.org. I'll take a moment to introduce our moderator, leave to him to introduce our panel, and then I'll get off your screens. Today, we're fortunate to have with us as our moderator, former Minnesota Supreme Court Justice Barry Anderson, who joined the court on October 13th, 2004, and served through to his retirement on May 10th, 2024. He's previously a partner in the Minneapolis and Hutchinson law firm of Arnold Anderson and Dove, PLLP, and also served the city of Hutchinson as city attorney from 1987 to 1998. Justice Anderson also served on the Minnesota Judicial Council, the managing body for the Minnesota Judicial Branch, and his background includes substantial public service, including as a board member and chair of a variety of community organizations, including service clubs, task forces, and local public access channel, as well as a wide variety of other community activities. A last note, and then I'll get off your screens. If you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so it'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Justice Anderson, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction, and welcome and thank all of you for joining us for what I think is going to be a very interesting discussion on judicial speech restrictions and elections. I'm going to begin with an introduction of our panel in alphabetical order, beginning with the Honorable Clint Bolick, who is a justice on the Supreme Court of Arizona. He was appointed by Governor Doug Ducey on January 6, 2016, and previously was the Vice President for Litigation at the Goldwater Institute. The New York Times has noted that Justice Bolick is known for his aggressive litigation to defend individual liberties. And before he joined the Goldwater Institute, he was co-founder of organizations that I think are well known to many of us, the Institute for Justice, and later served as president for the Alliance of School Choice. He's written a number of books and was recognized in 2003 by American Lawyer as one of the three lawyers of the year for his successful defense of school choice programs. We're delighted to have Justice Bolick with us. Also joining us today is the Honorable Brett Busby, who is a justice on the Texas Supreme Court. He was appointed there in 2019, confirmed unanimously by the Texas Senate, and elected to a full term in 2020. He served as an appellate litigator in Houston, also served on the 14th Court of Appeals. I'm always partial to people who began their careers on the Court of Appeals, as well as on the Texas Multi-District Litigation Panel. I do note that he's a seventh-generation Texan who has actually spent some time in Minnesota. We won't actually inquire about that with him. He's a graduate with honors from Duke University and Columbia Law School and served as a law clerk to Justices Byron White and John Paul Stevens, as well as to a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. And he has substantial experience in presenting oral arguments in the United States Supreme Court and appeals elsewhere. And then also joining us, an important guest on this program and an important participant on this panel, given the topic, is the Honorable Dan Kelly, who is a former justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, our neighbor here in Minnesota to the east. He was appointed to the Supreme Court by Governor Scott Walker in 2016 and is a native of Santa Barbara, California. And came to Waukesha, Wisconsin, to study at what is now known as Carroll University, where he earned a bachelor's degree in political science and Spanish. He earned his law degree from Regent University School of Law and had 19 years' experience as a private practice attorney in Wisconsin. He had substantial appellate experience in cases before the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court. His time in private practice was spent with one of the largest and oldest law firms in Wisconsin. He has subsequently served as vice president and general counsel for a philanthropic foundation, and then practiced law at a firm owned that he owned and founded in Waukesha. And I'm partial to Justice Kelly. One of my sons is a graduate of law school and undergraduate degree in Wisconsin. So I've heard a great deal about the Badgers. They're almost as good as the Gophers, but we'll leave that for another discussion at another time. Now, before we get to our panel, I'd like to set the stage a bit. Among us, we represent four states with differing judicial selection systems. The term judicial elections means something different in each of these states, but between them, I think we've got a reasonably fair representation for how most states handle the process. Some 37 states of our 50 states have some form of judicial election. And of course, we have some states, primarily in the East, that have almost a purely appointive model. Arizona is a hybrid state involving contested elections and a merit selection process. Justices of the peace throughout the state are subject to partisan elections. Court judges in smaller population-wise counties are subject to nonpartisan contested elections. Most trial judges and all appellate judges in the state are chosen via merit selection. That selection process kicks off with an announcement of a vacancy, and those interested in the position apply to a nominating commission made up of lawyers and public members. The commissions nominate at least three, but often more, candidates for the governor to consider. The governor appoints, and there's no confirmation step in Arizona. Judges chosen through this process then sit for a retention election, which is an uncontested yes or no vote on each judge appearing on the ballot. Judges are listed by court and name only. No other designation is provided. Minnesota, my state, elects judges in nonpartisan elections. They look more like traditional candidate-based elections where there may be a challenger, but no party affiliation appears on the ballot. We do have a merit selection commission, but interestingly enough, it's advisory only. Governors do not have to follow the recommendations that are made with respect to trial court judges. Appellate judges are not required to go through that process. Having said all of that, most governors do use some appellate process commission format in appointing members to the appellate courts. Texas elects its judges via partisan elections, which allows for straight ticket party line votes on judges. And I think that we'll hear from Justice Busby what some of the implications are of this option. If a midterm vacancy arises, the governor appoints the replacement, which is subject to Senate confirmation. And the replacement judge must stand in the next election, which could be a contested election. Finally, we get to Wisconsin, which is similar to Minnesota in that it has a nonpartisan election model. No party affiliation appears, but the elections can be contested. Midterm vacancies are filled by gubernatorial appointments involving a recommending but not binding commission. One feature in comparing the Minnesota and Wisconsin systems is, although both have nonpartisan elections, the Wisconsin elections are held in the off part of the year. The Minnesota elections are held on a general election date in November, along with other offices. And that may have some implications for some of the comments that Dan Kelly will be sharing with us in a bit. Now, that's our election system landscape. What about our speech restriction landscape? I anticipate we'll get some comments from that from our distinguished panelists. As mentioned, our four panelists have impressive biographies, and if you want more information, they're available on the webpage. We welcome audience questions, and we hope to get to as many of them as time allows, and you may submit questions through the question and answer feature in Zoom, which I'm at least borderline competent technically to operate, and if not, I can have help from our introduction this morning who can direct me as needed. I'll do my best to keep track of those questions in my role as moderator. Justice Bolick, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about Arizona and your experiences.
Well, Barry, it's great to see you, and thanks to the Federalist Society for doing this. And it's great to be with my friends Brett and Dan as well. So Arizona is somewhat new to this debate. Our merit selection system was created in large part 50 years ago today by a then state legislator named Sandra Day O'Connor. And her effort was designed
to remove I think she has some significance to us.
Yes, she does. And certainly to Arizona. She was a huge advocate of removing politics to the extent, the greatest extent possible, and came up with this merit selection system that does have a retention feature to it. And the retention feature, she explained, was designed to give voters an opportunity to oust judges who did not meet the rigorous standards that are applied. We have a Judicial Performance Review Commission, which is bipartisan under the law and which is based largely on anonymous surveys by the parties who appear before us. And we have a record where judges who don't have a good temperament or are lazy or just are not up to par either retire after their JPR scores come out or are introduced to the joys of retirement by the voters. But it was only 2 years ago that the retention system became politicized for the first time. And this year, a year that I am on the ballot, we have the first full-throated effort to remove judges, including my colleague, Justice Kate King and me, ostensibly because of our recent decision on abortion, which was a statutory interpretation decision. But really, the groups that are coming after us want to replace us with ultimately with justices who will rubber stamp their ideological agenda. And my court does not rubber stamp anyone's agenda. In addition to being attacked by so-called progressive groups, we were recently censured by the Maricopa County Republican Executive Committee. So I think when both sides are attacking you, that's usually a pretty good illustration that you're doing the law rather than public policy. So it's a situation where judges who are up for retention are fighting with one arm tied behind their backs. Our ethics rules do not allow us to ask for campaign contributions, and they do not allow us to comment on issues. Just to give you one tangible example, I challenged the group that is leading the effort against retention to a debate on our local PBS station. The PBS station agreed to hear the debate, to sponsor the debate, and then they said, and we want you to express your views on a ballot measure dealing with retention that is on the ballot. And I read the ethics rules to preclude us from commenting on anything on the ballot that may very well come before us after the election. And so I had to decline. And as a result, we'll not have that that opportunity to address our critics. It's a real conundrum. On the one hand, I plan to press the boundaries of the First Amendment to the maximum possible extent as a judge. I certainly will defend our decisions. I will criticize or agree with U.S. Supreme Court opinions when asked. And so I definitely plan to be out there speaking to groups that invite me. But on the other hand, I won't have a campaign, and I will rely entirely on the efforts of third-party independent expenditure committees to act on our behalf. That's not an ideal situation because that means I'm not in charge of my own election effort. The flip side is, and these words I thought would never come out of my mouth, I don't want too many First Amendment rights. I don't want to take positions on ballot measures. And when I look around the country, and I know Dan is very sensitive to this, we've got judicial candidates who are taking positions on legal issues that will come before them. That to me is outrageous and compromises our ethics. I don't want to ask people for money, not only because my grandma once said it's impolite to ask people for money, but because I think that that sets a horrible precedent. I've litigated before becoming a judge in states that have contested judicial elections. I was always at a disadvantage in those states because I wasn't a contributor to judicial elections. And it sets a really horrible tone for those of us who want to preserve the integrity and independence of the judiciary who want to say and do say that we do have an independent judiciary. So we are experiencing these issues for the first time. I hope to beat back the challenge so that these sorts of things don't happen in Arizona again in the future. But if the opponents succeed, then this will be a politicized branch, and both sides will be firing at justices and judges with great enthusiasm, and we will become a state like Wisconsin, where we see we see $50 million campaigns for state Supreme Court justice races, and it will be a real tragedy and tarnish the legacy of Sandra Day O'Connor if it comes to that.
Thank you for that excellent discussion of the circumstances in Arizona. And now we turn to Texas. Justice Busby, can you help us with an outline of the Texas experience and as it relates to restrictions on speech?
Sure. Well, thanks, Barry and Clint and Dan. It's great to be with y'all. And thanks to the Federalist Society for having us. We do have a little bit of a different system in Texas, as was mentioned by Justice Anderson at the beginning. We do have our judges selected just like any other office in a partisan primary and general election. We used to have straight ticket voting. We actually did away with that a couple of election cycles ago, but for a while we were one of only three or four states that allowed voters to vote all Democrat or all Republican and have that count for judges as well. Now that's not allowed any longer to do straight ticket. The legislature changed that a couple of cycles ago, but we do run in a partisan primary and a general election. And as a result, we need to raise money and speak to voters to get our message out and get support on the ballot. We do have donation caps as far as the amount of money that we can raise, which I'm very glad about because we don't get into a West Virginia type situation. The caps are fairly low. And there's no, even for state Supreme Court races, we're talking about, $1 to $2 million raised total. So it's much less than you've seen in Wisconsin and much less than in our other statewide races for political offices in terms of the amount that's raised and spent in our races. So not infrequently, our court hears cases challenging the constitutionality of laws on issues where people have strong differences of opinion on the best public policy. Just recently, we've heard a challenge to a state abortion law, also a challenge to a law prohibiting certain treatments for transitioning a child's gender. And so voters often want to know, what do we think about these policies that come before our court? And perhaps that's natural because we are selected in a political process, but of course it's not a political job. And that's one of the points that me and many of my colleagues make is we're going out to speak to groups and talk about our candidacies, that the role of a judge is to decide cases based on the law as it is, based on the record before the court, not to say what we think the law should be, unless it's a common law case. And there's a role for that in those sorts of cases, which are generally not the ones that the voters know anything about or want to talk about. Now, in doing that, we do have a code of judicial conduct with restrictions. It's narrower than the codes in some other states. I had a chance to look at the ones in Arizona and Minnesota, for example. They have a lot more restrictions than ours does. But one of the big ones for Texas, and I think for pretty much every state, is that judges are not supposed to comment about pending or impending proceedings in a way that would suggest a future decision. Similarly, no promises regarding specific classes of cases or litigants or specific legal propositions that would suggest a future decision. Some savvy voters will say, but you have the right to free speech under Republican Party of Minnesota versus White. So I want to know what you think about these legal issues that may come before the court. And, you know, I think like Clint, I'm glad that we have these, you know, ethical restrictions and that we are bound by. And also, you know, the easy thing, another easy thing to point out and a true thing to point out is also if I were to, if I were to speak up on those, then you get into an issue of recusal. And if you suggest a future decision, you'll have to recuse yourself. So it's not just that, you know, there are issues of the ethics code. It's also issues of our recusal rules. And so, you know, I try to explain to people that and also that, you know, part of the important thing about the way a judge decides cases is that we don't prejudge them. We wait for them to come to us with concrete facts and good adversary presentation so that we can make that kind of a decision. Of course, also, our prohibitions in our Code of Judicial Conduct are much narrower than the announce clause that was at issue in Republican Party Minnesota versus White, where you couldn't announce views on disputed legal or political issues. So there's some, the tailoring analysis would probably be different, but it hasn't been challenged. And I think the reason it hasn't is because the recusal rules basically get you to the same place on those issues. But I will mention a decision from what we call a special court of review, which is what happens at the end of our judicial discipline process through our Judicial Conduct Commission. And this involved, I think it's instructive not only on judicial speech, but in the context of judicial selection involving a nomination process rather than an election process. And this is a decision called In re Hecht involving my friend and now our Chief Justice Nathan Hecht, who spoke favorably about his close friend Harriet Myers when she was nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court by President George W. Bush, said she would be a great justice, talked about her background, and he was admonished by our Judicial Conduct Commission for violating two canons. One was one authorizing the public, a prohibition against authorizing the public use of a judge's name endorsing another candidate for public office. Another one was against lending the prestige of your office to advance the private interests of others. And the Supreme Court majority, the majority of the Special Court of Review, unanimously, the court said that he had not violated those canons, but for two different reasons. The majority construed the canons quite narrowly and held that it was not a violation of the endorsing canon because he didn't expressly authorize the use of public use of his name to endorse Ms. Myers in the future. He said some things about her in interviews and otherwise. But the majority said that was not a violation of the canon. The second canon, the one about lending the prestige of office to advance the private interests of others, the majority said, well, that her nomination was not a matter of private interest. It was very much a matter of public interest and discussion. And so that was something that didn't violate the canon in that regard either. Interestingly, there was a concurrence that said that these canons were violated, but they were unconstitutional as applied under a White analysis because the endorsement prohibition was under-inclusive and the lending prestige prohibition was not narrowly tailored to serve the asserted interest in preserving judicial impartiality. So that's just one example of how some of these issues have come up in Texas where the rubber meets the road on White and some of the canons, albeit in a context where the comments were about a nomination process rather than an election process.
Thank you for that discussion about Texas, and thank you also for, as they say in the legal business, correcting the record on the straight ticket voting.
Positive change. So I want to be sure people know about it.
Yes, very good, very good. Let's turn now to a state that has had some direct experience with judicial elections that have garnered headlines and lots of coverage. And we have some, and our panel member today had some direct life experience with this situation. Justice Kelly, tell us a little bit about Wisconsin, if you would, please.
Well, I will. Thank you so much, Barry. I appreciate it. I appreciate the Federal Society for putting this on and having me to be a part of it. I understand that my role is to play the canary in the coal mine and perhaps warn of what is ahead of us with the politicization of our courts. As Barry said, we have nonpartisan elections for our judiciary here in Wisconsin, all the way from trial court up to the Supreme Court. And we really meant that we want these to be nonpartisan. For that reason, the elections for the judiciary are held in April, as opposed to the partisan elections, which are held in November. Now, if you look at a calendar, that's about as far away from November as you can possibly get. And the idea was to insulate the judicial elections from partisan influence. And for a long time, I think that worked reasonably well. But in an era in which sports, entertainment, and even sex are politicized, perhaps shouldn't come as a surprise that there's an impulse to politicize our courts as well. Now, the real surprise, I think, is that we've left ourselves vulnerable to that. We've left the door wide open for this to happen. An elective judiciary, I think, is an institutional engraved invitation to bring politics into campaigns, and after the campaigns, onto the bench, influencing the work of the court. Political speech, in my estimation, is just a manifestation of the problem. It's not the problem itself. The problem is the judicial elections get the speech incentives and the obligations of the office the candidate is seeking about as misaligned as it is possible to get. Now, the framers understood this and they acted accordingly. They understood that aligning the constituencies with the obligations of the office will influence the behavior both before the appointment, that is speech, and after, that is execution of the office's responsibilities. And that's why different offices under the United States Constitution had different constituencies. For example, the House had as its constituency the public, where it was free to express pure and unfiltered political passions. The Senate, on the other hand, its constituency were the states, qua states. The idea there is that they would pursue a more limited set of political issues and perhaps, ideally, in a more refined manner. And then the president was not directly, his constituency was not the general public, but through the College of Electors, so that there would be a broad cross-section of society that would be feeding into who would be the president. And then the judiciary, and this is where I think they got things right, really right. So there's no possibility of eliminating politics entirely from the process of staffing the judiciary. But what they did is they said, well, we're going to have the most insulated political aspects of our government choose the justices, the president and the Senate. And then afterwards, and here's the key, the justices would have no political constituency at all. Their constituency would be entirely the law. Now, I think the method of selection and the constituency affects the conduct of the office. Judicial elections here in Wisconsin and other states that have popular election appeal to the same constituency as the House of Representatives, the public and its passions, otherwise known as politics. We've structured this in a way that politics is merely an inevitable influence on the staffing of our judiciary. And campaign speech will naturally cater to the interests of the constituency. And that means the judges who are elected will always feel a gravitational pull towards political speech. It takes discipline and a deep understanding of the nature proper role of the judiciary to resist that gravitational pull. But resist it we must, because our role in the court has absolutely nothing to do with politics. But because the constituencies, the political public, the economic rule that you get more of what you subsidize and less of what you punish can't be avoided. And that dynamic naturally inclines judicial campaigns towards political speech that will still operate after the election. And that's because elections do two things. They select, and they also hold accountable. Now, once elected on a political platform, however cleverly camouflaged as quote unquote my values, the elected jurist will experience a pull towards manifesting those values in his or her work on the court. Because the elected jurist knows that he or she will face election again. And if he doesn't make good on the implied promises, the political electorate will find someone else. Now, in my personal experience, I ran the first time in 2020. And notwithstanding the separation of partisan and nonpartisan elections, the state legislature, in all its wisdom, chose to have the Democratic presidential primary on the same day as my general election. Now, normally that wouldn't be a problem if there were primaries in both parties. But in 2020, there really weren't. There was just the Democratic presidential primary. And people turn out for presidential elections in a way they don't turn out for any other electoral contest. And that occurred in April 2020. My opponent campaigned as a social justice warrior. Now, that's a term that's not really used that much today. But if you recall back in the late great days of the 2020, social justice warrior was coding for being liberal, being a Democrat. And so as she campaigned around the state as a social justice warrior, all of the Democrats who would go out to vote in the Democratic presidential primary knew that my opponent was their person. Now, I figured that was an anomaly, and that didn't really reflect where Wisconsin was at. And so I chose to run again in 2023 when there was an open seat. And if you recall, just that prior August was the Dobbs decision overruling Roe and sending the question of abortion back to the states. And my campaign in 2023 was the first judicial campaign after Dobbs. And so abortion could be a major impact on that race if the candidates allowed it. Now, the way I campaign is to talk about the proper role and function of the judiciary, and that involves primarily procedural questions, right? How do you make decisions? What's the role of precedent? How do you resolve statutory ambiguities? What's the original public meaning of the constitutional text? My opponent in that election ran as the champion of women's reproductive rights. And she characterized this as being, quote unquote, her values. Now, in an election climate right after the overturning of Roe, if you go out and you talk about your values being the protection of abortion, that issue has a power to bring people to the polls unlike any other. And it did its magic in 2023, and she won handily by campaigning on a purely political issue. And I think, and in addition, as Barry mentioned, right, and maybe it was you, Glenn, it was an extraordinarily expensive election. Circa $50 million. And unfortunately, I think what is possible to occur in the future is that other states with elected judiciaries will take the lesson from Wisconsin and they'll say there were no consequences to politicizing the judicial campaigns. And there was no, there were no consequences to massive political contributions to judicial campaigns. In Wisconsin, the political parties can make unlimited donations to judicial campaigns. Now, I rejected that because I did not want the judiciary to be perceived as being owned by the political branches. My opponent did not do similarly. And so she accepted millions upon millions upon millions of dollars in an amount that dwarfed what the United States Supreme Court considered a violation of due process. And there were no consequences to it, either legally or electorally. And I'm afraid that other states around the country with elective judiciaries will take the lesson from Wisconsin, and they will increasingly politicize their judicial campaigns, and that the money will follow the politics, and we'll see money pour into those campaigns as they did in Wisconsin. So it's, I think the solution to this is to align the incentives for the campaigns with the responsibilities of the office. And I think that's why the framers got it right in having a presidential nomination, Senate confirmation, lifetime tenure system. That is as close as you can possibly get to squeezing politics out of the staffing of the judiciary, and then giving at least the best opportunity possible for the jurist's constituency to be nothing but the law.
Thank you, Justice Kelly, for that discussion of the circumstances that have arisen in Wisconsin. I just want to say a couple words about Minnesota because, of course, in some respects, litigation involving the state of Minnesota sort of kicked off this conversation. One of the issues that I run into, I was on the ballot three times as a member of the court, challenged once. We raised and spent about $150,000, which this number doesn't even begin to impress Justice Kelly or Justice Busby based on their life experiences. But that was considered unusual. I had a challenger where we felt we needed to do that. We do have rules that try to attempt to address some of these issues, which results in members of the court, for example, seeking re-election. You might hold a fundraising kind of event, but you're not there for the fundraising part. You give your pitch for what the court does and how you do it and why everyone should support you, and leave the money raising to other people. But in having discussions with Minnesotans about our judicial election process, you often hear, well, we're not like Wisconsin, or we're not like Texas or Louisiana or some other place. I call it the Garrison Keillor effect. Everybody here is above average. The problem with that is it's not true. And so when you dive into Minnesota history, it's interesting to learn that from 1890 to about 1912, we had partisan judicial elections. Political parties were involved in endorsing and running campaigns. At least if I've got the data correct here, I think there were seven members of the court, incumbents, who were defeated in various elections. Since we moved to a more nonpartisan format, and some other kinds of reforms, some of which, of course, have been affected by Republican Party v. White, since 1940, well, the last incumbent justice in Minnesota to be beaten was William Christensen from Red Wing in 1946. And it was basically a name identification situation. A relative of somebody already on the court defeated him. It wasn't a major tragedy in his case. For those of you who know something about Judge Christensen's history, he wound up going on to serve as one of the judges on the Nuremberg trials. So it all worked out for him. But anyway, from the standpoint of the public and judicial election process, the feedback you get from Minnesotans is, well, it can't happen here. And I'm sure we would hear that in other states. The reality is, once you have that set of circumstances, convincing the genie to voluntarily go back into the bottle doesn't really seem to work very well. And then it creates problems with what kind of reform you're going to have. We had a reform effort in Minnesota chaired by the late former Republican governor, Al Quie, made some recommendations to the legislature, basically a retention model that would look very similar to the model that that exists now in Arizona, ultimately couldn't get it on the ballot, and there was no action on it. If I have the history correct, I don't believe that since the Jacksonian era began in the 1830s, states have begun moving to judicial elections. No state has completely and utterly abandoned judicial elections for a model that is completely different. There have been changes in the type of elections. Alaska, of course, I think has had a retention model almost from the beginning of its time as statehood. And as we heard from Justice Pollack, Arizona went to a different election model, but it's still an election. And the tension between elections and the work the judges are expecting to do is significant and perhaps unresolvable. We do have some questions, but before I get to the questions, I want to give members of the panel an opportunity to react to some of the statements that have been made by other members of the panel and to offer any insights they have, and then we'll get to some of those questions that have been asked. Open mic. What do you all think about what you've heard today?
So I wanted to react to something that Brett said and ask Dan a question. Brett, I was so happy to hear what happened in Chief Justice Heck's case. We are not allowed to endorse even our colleagues, but I, at every chance I get, talk about how fantastic my colleague Justice Kate King is. And it's nice to know that there is a precedent in Texas that might shield my First Amendment rights and Arizona Constitution rights to say something along those lines. Dan, I wanted to ask you, in a state where candidates are making overtly political statements and weighing in on issues that also are legal issues, have there been any motions for disqualification or judicial complaints filed where the judges ultimately rule on cases like that?
Yeah, there have been surprisingly few, frankly. Probably about 12 years ago now, involved a candidate's TV commercial, but that wasn't even a question of politicization. The allegation was that it was simply inaccurate, and there was a complaint that was filed. It went through. There's a committee that looks at this before it gets forwarded on to the Supreme Court for resolution, and the candidate for whom this commercial was run won the election, so he didn't take part in the resolution of the complaint. But that meant that it tied 3-3, and so the prosecution of the complaint was abandoned. There were a few complaints filed against my opponents in my elections, the agency that handles these has a great deal of discretion on whether to pursue them, and they simply chose not to. As far as recusals go, they tend to be in one direction. They come from individuals and organizations who are on the political left, and they're filed against those who are perceived as being on the political right. And so I had one request for recusal during my time on the court, and it was with respect to my prior relationship with an institutional litigator that had brought a claim to the court. And years prior to that, I had served on a committee for this organization in selecting issues that they might want to think about litigating. And the issue that was before the court had absolutely nothing to do with any of the work that I had done those many years ago. And so I denied their request. And that was about as far as it went. But the thing that surprised me was that there were no requests for recusal when, for example, one of the members of the court who'd received millions of dollars in contributions from a political party then sat on a case that dealt with partitioning the state for the legislature. And just no apparent concerns at all with that. So it really hasn't, the concerns about politicization have not really turned into judicial complaints. They've just focused on the front end, making sure they get what they wanted.
Hmm. And I might just add one of the other, I think we haven't seen quite the same types of statements in Texas, Dan, that you were mentioning that your opponent had made. And of course, one reason for that may be that we run on a party ticket. And so people may assume that we have certain positions when, you know, accurately or not. We also do have pretty active primaries in some parts of the state. And so you see a little bit more of that kind of language in some of the primaries, happily still not a lot. But one thing that may deter that is we just have so many judges on the ballot in Texas. When I ran in 2018 on the Court of Appeals in Houston, we had 70 judicial races on the ballot in Houston. So that would be 100. If you wanted to cast an informed vote, you would have to learn the qualifications of 140 candidates for 70 seats in a general election. And even the lawyers don't have any idea who those people are. And so, I understand why we chose judicial elections in Texas, although it was originally an appointive system, but became an elective system after Reconstruction. But I understand why that was one thing in the 1860s and 70s, you know, when everybody knew their neighbors and, you know, maybe there were a couple of judges on the ballot. But just to think that the voters can make an informed choice with 70 races on the ballot is pretty stretches credulity, I guess you could say, strains credulity. But and chief justices of both parties in Texas have called for judicial selection reform, and it's just not something that has been taken up. I think, as was mentioned earlier, it's very rare for states to go from, or maybe none, going from elections to non-elections.
Go to some of the questions that we've received from our viewers. We have a question from one viewer who wants to know, to what extent do the supposedly bipartisan or nonpartisan judicial nominating and review commissions fall prey to institutional capture, often with inherent partisan or ideological bias by lawyer groups? I want to throw that question open to the panel. And while you're thinking about possible responses, I would note that one of the decisions that was made early on in the Minnesota merit selection process, which, as I noted earlier, is voluntary, is the Bar Association was just cut out altogether. Governor makes the majority appointments to the commission, but there's a substantial number of appointments that are made by the Supreme Court. And at least in theory, anyway, those are all accountable to the voters. I don't mean this to sound like I'm personally critical of Bar Associations. I realize that there are issues with them. But certainly it's readily apparent that the National Bar Association and many state bar associations have ideological positions. Anybody else want to comment on that question?
Yeah, Barry, I'm glad that question came up because that gives a great opportunity to dispel some myths that have formed in Wisconsin. And I wouldn't doubt in other states as well. So one of the knocks that I received after I was appointed to the Supreme Court was that Governor Walker was just appointing his friends to the Supreme Court. And the first time I heard that, I laughed, because prior to the final interview, before appointment, I had never before had a private conversation with the governor. That's how little of a connection there was between the two of us. But he had put together a Judicial Selection Advisory Committee with a bunch of extraordinarily principled and intelligent folks. As I went through it, I was extraordinarily pleased to find that never once was I asked a question about a political question, a political position. Never once was I asked how I would rule in a given circumstance. What it was, and you know, for the legal nerds amongst us, I think you'll enjoy this. It was just a very extended conversation about the proper role and function of the judiciary within a constitutional structure. So so we talked about, how do you construe the Constitution? A Constitution that's over 200 years old. What does it mean to seek the original public meaning of the text? How do you resolve statutory ambiguities? What do you do with stare decisis? What's the standing of prior opinions of the court? It was all about the process that a proper jurist would follow in deciding cases. And so I think it is possible to put together a process that would look for people who would be faithful to the proper role and function of the judiciary. But the problem, of course, is that that's not a public process. And so the public doesn't see that going on. And so they have a tendency to think that politics and personal relationships is what drives the decisions, when it's simply not the case.
Arizona's got a very, Clint, can you talk a little bit about the Arizona experience? Because they've got a very robust system there.
Yes. So our nominating commissions are bipartisan by law. And they also have a majority of non-lawyers on them. The role of the Bar Association in nominating and selecting those members has been greatly diminished in recent years. And and also the Judicial Performance Review Commission is required to be bipartisan as well. And I chair the Maricopa County Superior Court Nominating Commission, which of course is by far the biggest. And I'm really happy to report that the culture of those commissions is so strong in terms of merit selection. And we do have to nominate to the governor bipartisan list as well. But the difference between the commission with a majority of nominees from Governor Ducey and now a majority of commissioners chosen by Governor Hobbs, you wouldn't know there was a difference, even though, you know, most of the commissioners before were Republican and most now are Democrats. When they vote, when they discuss nominees, you actually wouldn't know that there was a difference. And I am really happy about that. It means that the process is working like it was intended to work, which is to make sure that the nominees are good lawyers that have conducted themselves professionally over the course of their careers. And then once they do become judges, they are continually checked through this survey process that allows not only winning lawyers, but losing lawyers to comment on the judges as well. And so the system works really, really well. And that's what's at stake this year is, will that system be hijacked and turn into a political system? And it would be a terrible shame. When I left DC, that my wife and I chose Arizona was the quality and independence and integrity of the judiciary, where I would be litigating most of my cases. And, Democrat judges, Republican judges have just been really, really excellent. And chosen without regard to partisan affiliation. And that's it's been a great system, and I hope that it survives the horrible election year of 2024.
So we have a question from a viewer who notes that in Minnesota we have a rule that prohibits candidates for judicial office from directly soliciting campaign contributions sending that issue to a campaign committee, and I think there are other states that do something similar. But our viewer's question is, in prohibiting the candidate or the judicial candidate from asking for cash, is that a distinction without a meaningful difference? And I will say, from somebody who had sort of that experience in my 2012 race, I think it is a distinction that makes some sense, and that there is a difference. And I'll tell you that one of the main principal differences is you just are not in the business of asking for money. And it's not necessarily just even a partisan reference and asking Republicans for money or Democrats for money, but just dialing up people and asking them to support your campaign financially. I think it creates issues. Now, I don't know, Brett, what's the rule in Texas? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, we raise our own funds. I'd be delighted to pass it off to a committee, but that's not the system that we have. Just from a personal, I don't like raising money, but it's what we have to do to be able to get our message out. But, you know, I think I don't know that it would stop people from saying, oh, that judge just decided for this person because they gave money to the campaign, because they're going to give it, you know, either through a committee or to you directly. So I don't think it would stop that. But I think for people, I think it sort of helps, you know, and I don't know that it probably doesn't affect judges more one way or the other than just being glad to be rid of making calls. But I think it helps from, you know, part of the design of all of these rules is not just the fact of impartiality, but the appearance of impartiality. And I think that's an important value as well, because we want people to feel that they're getting a fair shake, as well as actually getting a fair shake. And so I think having a committee with some degree of distance may help with that a bit on the margin.
A couple of comments that I'm not sure they're questions, but I'm going to pass them along. We had an anonymous viewer who pointed out that in some states, and in that viewer's state in particular, the trial lawyer's candidate always seems to get through and others don't, and believes that the process there really is not accurately, is not being handled in a way that is objective or fair. And then we had another comment from a viewer who noted that one of the problems with getting into the game is you involve, and I don't mean game in a judgmental sense, but getting into the business of supporting candidates, that triggers a response from the other side. And so if your state leans to the left, and conservatives attempt to fund a challenger, that's going to encourage a response. And the reverse is also true. If your state leans to the right, it may encourage a response. These, I think, are both legitimate points. I don't have a solution for either one of them, except to say that if you're going to have elections, you're going to have to raise money. We are rapidly running out of time. Oh, I see I had one more question come in.
Yeah, I can see this one, Barry, about the candidate from Florida who identified herself as conservative in some of her messaging, and the Supreme Court, they're saying that's not a violation, even though she subjected herself to discipline herself. I hadn't heard about this case, but there would be a lot of judges who run in our, if that were a violation, there would be a lot of judges who are campaigning in our system that would be guilty of it. But it's not, you know, not considered that in but not considered a violation in Texas to identify yourself as conservative or liberal or what have you.
The violation would apparently be, according to the viewer, the violation would be identifying by a political party.
Right, so which of course we already do.
Yeah, so, and I've noticed, Brett, I just had occasion to bump into the political parties themselves will say on their websites, these are the judges from the various political parties. So they really mean it in Texas, I guess.
Well, that's right. But also, I mean, we've ruled in favor, you know, we've had our court rule in favor of both parties on different issues over the years. So kind of like Clint was saying, you know, if you're pleasing nobody or you know, some person's unhappy with you, maybe you're just applying the law.
Well, I see we've run out of time here. Kayla, do you have any last thoughts for us before we adjourn our webinar today?
Just would like to thank you all as our panel for sharing your expertise and insight today. We really appreciate you carving out the section of your afternoons and sharing your insights. Thank you also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.